loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we take a look at the Korean Peninsula and the prospects for peace. The Trump administration and the South Korean government have confirmed that scheduled U.S. war exercises that simulate the destruction of North Korea have been canceled. At the same time, North Korean President Kim Jong-un is in China for the third time. We'll take a look at the big picture on the Korean Peninsula. And then we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday where we talk about the big issues in the economy. It's called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing featuring the Justice Department's Inspector General and the FBI Director continues to make news. Inspector General Michael Horowitz defended his finding that political bias played no role in the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, although he said that he was deeply concerned about the inappropriate and unethical behavior and actions of dozens of FBI agents. Next, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were American citizens who were accused in the 1950s of spying for the Soviet Union. They were put through a politically charged trial and quickly convicted, despite convincing evidence that Ethel was innocent of any crime and Julius was guilty of no more than a minor one. 65 years ago today, they were executed. Their sons, Michael and Robert Mirapol, have worked for years to clear their parents' names. Then, a former CIA employee was charged with multiple counts of espionage for allegedly leaking documents that became known as the Vault 7 revelations. And then, political pressure is growing rapidly on the Trump administration to end its policy of separating migrant families at the border. A poll released yesterday shows that 66% of Americans oppose the policy, the United Nations declared it a form of child abuse, and even Republican senators are sponsoring bills to end it immediately. And finally, today, the 19th of June, is Juneteenth, which commemorates the day in 1865 when 250,000 slaves in Texas were finally told that they were free, 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. 153 years later, Juneteenth is still relevant, as people of color still struggle for equal rights in the United States and as migrants fight to keep their families together. And in other headlines, the Trump administration is widely expected to withdraw the United States from the United Nations Human Rights Council later today. The administration accuses the council, which recently opened an investigation into the mass shooting of Palestinian protesters by Israeli snipers along the border of Gaza, of being biased against Israel. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are scheduled to speak on the issue at 5 o'clock. Representatives of the Russian, Turkish, and Iranian governments, along with members of the Syrian opposition, are meeting in Geneva, Switzerland today. The delegates are discussing the creation of a committee to write a new constitution for Syria. This summit comes as a follow-up to the Syrian National Dialogue Conference held in Sochi, Russia, in January. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Sherrod Brown have announced that they will move to hold up the confirmation of the Trump administration's nominee to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The nominee, Kathy Craninger, is currently an official at the Office of Management and Budget who oversees the budget for the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. Warren said that as a consequence, Craninger, quote, helps oversee the agencies that are ripping immigrant kids from their parents, unquote. The Senate is again pushing the White House to clamp down on Chinese technology firm ZTE, passing a bill to that effect yesterday with a vote of 85-10. This provision was folded into a larger defense spending bill. Many of the supporters of the provision are Republican senators in a break with President Trump's agenda. The White House is expected to lobby hard against it. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the U.S. stopping military drills on the Korean Peninsula. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
But first we turn to Korea. The United States and South Korea have canceled a major military exercise scheduled for August after President Trump made the surprise concession in Singapore last week. Meanwhile, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing for consultations. He's also been invited to visit Moscow and Washington and rumored to have been invited to Japan. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Medea Benjamin. She is an anti-war and anti-torture activist. She is the co-founder of Code Pink. And we're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Medea and Simone, welcome back.
Yay, thanks for having us on. Thanks for having us.
So you two are our sisters, in the, at least in the biblical sense. You were both in the DMZ in Panmunjom not too long ago. Talk about why you were there and what actually happened.
Medea, why don't you go ahead first?
Well, first to say that it was wonderful being with a group of women from around the world, and we were in Korea as part of an effort that started in 2015 when we crossed from North Korea to the South. This time we couldn't go to North Korea because Donald Trump had placed a travel ban. The only country we can't travel to in the world right now is North Korea. But we were able to spend time with leaders of women's movements in the South to meet with the U.S. Embassy there. And in fact, we were there at the time when Donald Trump had announced that the summit was off and quickly did a protest outside the embassy, a candlelight vigil with the Korean folks. And when he announced that it was on again, there was tremendous delight. And we then did a peace walk across the Friendship Bridge and to the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. And we, in general, had a great time following up with a lot of the groups that we had met with a few years before, who, along with us, never thought we would be at this stage right now.
Let's talk about that. It is pretty breathtaking, Simone, that we are where we are. Kim Jong-un meeting with Donald Trump last week in Singapore. He's in Beijing again for the third visit. This time announced in advance, that's clear that China and the DPRK have a deepening, a warming, a strengthening relationship. Kim Jong-un has also been invited at least to Moscow. Donald Trump says he wants him to come to the White House. At the same time, the U.S. media, with rare exception, is treating the whole development, the whole possibility of peace in Korea as something quite awful. Anyway, talk about why this is happening right now.
Yes, I think that we first have to mention again the amazing Singapore summit, which, as you mentioned, that there was it was well received, and also especially for many the peace activists and also the Korean Americans. As you remember, before the summit, there were some 153 organizations across the United States and around the world, released a statement and calling for a really formal end to Korean War, and especially urging, in this case, if you remember, Washington's political leaders to set aside the partisan differences and party politics for peace in Korea. And so I think this is truly, it was a very interesting experience. And, although as you everyone agrees that it was a short and specific, but it was an very important first step. And however, I think I did participate in Korea Peace Network's advocacy visit to U.S. Senators and Congress members last week, and I was just simply amazed how the starkly very different appraisal of the Singapore summit. And there was, in general, it was very critical. They were basically, in general, because there was some really just very opposition to the summit and anything that Trump said, does, there are a lot of Democratic senators or Congress members were not, refused to give any support. So it was very somewhat a feeling, I was very disappointed. But that being said, I think that we still have very strong momentum because, as you know, in the latest local election in South Korea, basically progressive, has the ruling party has a landslide victory. And Koreans, 70-80% Korean support. And even American public opinion just came out of, this is a very divided country, but still, despite Trump's unpopularity, and more than 51%, support the peace agreement and the Korean Peninsula. So I think that put everything in perspective. I think that we are heading to the right direction, and everything that we are doing here our peace activists are a good thing. And about this, Kim Jong-un's third visit to China, you know, this is obviously China is the most important player here. I mean, China is the one that actually they can, you know, do something about lifting economic sanctions, helping to lift economic sanctions, and also providing economic assistance to North Korea, which is really, really suffering a lot, which I think from the sanction, which I think Medea wrote about it in The Guardian, and she can perhaps talk more about it. And also China provides, you know, diplomatic sheltering to North Korea. And most importantly, if, you know, anything happened to North Korea, China can also provide some kind of security assurance. And so if we, you know, taking all these things in perspective, we are truly still in a process of transition. But I think I feel that we are heading to the right direction. And I hope that America, more bipartisan support, and American media, you know, take a more gentler and softer approach toward Korea.
You know, one of the things that surprised me in the news coverage all through the summit was that no one ever asked, and I mean this quite literally, no one ever asked what the South Korean people think about this. We had this odd role reversal here in the United States where Democrats condemned Donald Trump for standing with a despot and having the American flag soiled by hanging next to the North Korean flag and all this nonsense that the Democrats were spouting all week long. But no one ever said anything about the South Koreans and what the South Korean people have been saying about the prospects for real peace that would allow the reunification of families, for example, or new business opportunities for South Korean and for North Korean businessmen. What are we missing, Medea?
Well, I think you're totally right, and it's very sad, and it shows a lack of understanding that this is really about Korea much more than it is about the United States. It shows a lack of any kind of empathy or putting themselves in the shoes of the Korean people to understand that living for almost 70 years in a state of fear of each other, this is such a massive breakthrough. And my particular distress was when I saw a poll that came out 2 days ago by the Washington Post that showed another reversal, which is a majority of women, twice as much as men, thought the summit was a bad thing, thought that it was not going to lessen the chances of war, thought that the North Koreans were not going to give up their nuclear weapons, and thought that Trump gave away too much. In fact, while a majority of men, 55%, said Trump made reasonable compromises, only 27% of women said that, and a much larger percentage, 40%, said he gave away too much. This just shows how skewed the media has been, because certainly North Korea gave away a lot more than the United States. And the whole idea that the U.S., that Trump agreed to put a halt to these military exercises should be seen as something extremely positive for us here in the United States. And Donald Trump was right when he said that those are provocative exercises. So, yes, the media has been very skewed and led to U.S. people not understanding how this is not about us. It's about the Koreans.
Yeah. One thing, Simone, it's an important thing, actually. When you look at the joint declaration, the joint statement that Trump and Kim Jong-un signed, I don't have it in front of me, but I remember it pretty well. Point number one was an improvement in U.S.-North Korean relations based on the desires of the peoples of both countries. Number two was to set up a permanent ongoing peace mechanism so that there could be conflict resolution rather than another war on the Korean Peninsula. Number three out of the 4 points was about denuclearization. It wasn't number one. It was number three. And then number four was returning the remains of American POWs or missing in action from the Korean War. Now, it seemed to me that Donald Trump, thus, after having canceled the summit when it was clear that the DPRK was unhappy, had in fact stopped communicating about logistics because they thought that John Bolton and Mike Pence and the Washington attitude was The summit is just about you surrendering. You give up everything. You have a comprehensive, irreversible denuclearization. And in exchange, you get nothing except a promise that someday you'll have some relief from sanctions. The DPRK said that's not the way this is going to work. And Trump, in a way, heard them. And so the statement reflects what the DPRK was insisting on as their precondition for getting rid of nuclear weapons, which is a change in the U.S. policy, which has been premised on animus and hostility. That's quite a remarkable achievement diplomatically, it would seem to me, for the DPRK.
Yes, I think it is an important achievement. As you know, no American leader or no American president met with the North Korean leader since 1945. This is the first time. So it is truly historic. And secondly, and I think that you're right, American did not include the what it called Bolton's idea, or that is a CVID. I think there was a lot of people critical of the not including the complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement of the North Korean nuclear program. But this is, I think, there was also positive. I think that is also, that cannot be actually, there will be negotiation killer. And so instead of including more sort of positive, cooperative trust building actions, such as North Korea's agreeing to repatriate the remains of a U.S. servicemen. And also, as you pointed out, that the biggest takeaway of that summit was basically to create a very peace regime on the Korean Peninsula and also reduce the immediately the military tension, which is related with the U.S. Trump announcing the cessation, halting of the war game. And also now, as you point out, as we know that North Korea is most likely to remove some of the long-range artillery from border, DMZ, about like 30 to 40 kilometers to the rear, so which also means that North Korea is also making step-by-step reciprocal action to reduce the military tension on the Korean Peninsula, which then eventually will lead to something that we all want, that is peace treaty, right? And also, I think that here, I think we should point out that, as Madia pointed out, and as all of us acknowledge, how still is a very delicate and a very, very, uncertain process. This is why that we need all the support that we can get, especially we need to really, make a response to those hardline and the neocon, and also people who are really trying to scuttle the peace process. And still the most, I think the biggest deal, I think the big picture is, we're not talking about just the denuclearization of North Korea. We really have to start talking about denuclearization of the entire Northeast Asia. What ultimately has to also address is that, the U.S. nuke forces from the region should be, addressed. We still don't have the, concrete words from the United States. What are you going to do, U.S. new forces that, hovering around Northeast Asia, B-52s, B-1 bombers, Trident nuke submarines, etc. So I think that the big picture is, again, there's still the nuclear-free Northeast Asia. That has to be also addressed within this context of denuclearization of a Korean Peninsula.
Well, let's talk about these longer-term goals. Medea, do you think the chances of a peace treaty, of real denuclearization, of reunification of families, do you think these are really in the offing?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think the weakest link in all of this is Trump. But when you look at North and South Korea, and now certainly the Chinese, that this is the third time in just a few months that Kim Jong-un has been to China. And if you look at the way things have been moving forward so fast on the Korean Peninsula, I think there is just momentum that is remarkable. So our job is to keep Donald Trump in check and to stop all of the bashing and to make sure that in Congress they don't put so many obstacles in his way. This is supposed to be a peace treaty, unlike the Iran nuclear deal that was just an executive agreement to pass through the Senate. And the way it looks right now, it's not just a simple majority of 51, but you need a plurality, you need two-thirds. I don't see how enough Democrats are going to side with Republicans to pass this. So I think that's our real hang up is going to be right here at home.
Yeah, that is the problem. Actually, it's always been the problem. And there has to be an alignment of sort of a congruence of things. There has to be a progressive government in South Korea. There has to be a sense of security from North Korea. There has to be somebody, most importantly, as Medea is saying, in the White House who says, yes, this is a good idea. It started to appear to be the case in the last year of the Clinton administration, where the North and South met together. They had the historic June 15th, 2000 summit. There was a declaration of the promise, the optimism that something was going to change. And of course, because Clinton seemed to favor it, it seemed like all signals were go. But then George W. Bush came in and he torpedoed it. But then again, Simone, the world situation seems to be changing. Well, it obviously has changed. We're 18 years later. Let's talk about, though, the problem of the UN sanctions. Because the UN Security Council, having passed sanctions, those sanctions have the power, the force of international law. And so even if Russia or China want to ease the UN sanctions, the U.S., because it has a veto power at the Security Council, can just veto it. Then how do and how will, if Russia and China, for instance, want to sort of do something demonstrable to help the situation in response to the DPRK's concessions, what can they do economically?
I think that China and Russia have since the summit meeting, Singapore meeting, China and Russia have already expressed that, you know, the international sanctions to be lifted. And also, we have the study shows that observers show that there is already some sign of loosening of China's enforcement of UN sanctions along the Sino-DPRK borders. For instance, there's a study about ship tracking and multiple. They've saw that the multiple DPRK lift the ships, you know, at ports, etc. And so I think that definitely China and Russia's cooperation will actually, you know, help to convince Trump maybe lifting, you know, some of the sanctions. And also we have to understand why these sanctions are horrible. You know, the sanctions are, as our international humanitarian peace activists point out, the sanctions are not tools of diplomacy. This is the weapons of war. Actually, DPRK, North Korea is receiving sanctions. It is a form of warfare against the people who are the weakest and pregnant women and children and elderly. And also, right now, UN sanctions having really truly crippling North Korea's economy. You know, the study shows that North Korea export has dwindled, and soon foreign currency in North Korea is going to completely drown out. And so this is very, very serious situation. So I think that at this point, Kim Jong-un is going to visiting China, and we don't know how fast the sanctions are going to be lifted, although the United States is refusing, clearly saying that they're not going to lift the sanctions unless North Korea make a progress toward denuclearization. But I still feel, though, there are rooms to alleviate the effect. And another thing is that I mentioned earlier that there are some 200 some different ways that South Korea, inter-Korean economic cooperation can also can be exempted from UN sanctions. So I think that probably that's another way that we can also address. And still, you know, the most important one is, you know, as Medea pointed out in her an article, and, you know, United Nations estimate some like 6,000 North Korean children are at risk of starvation as a direct result of international sanctions. So this humanitarian cost of this war, the sanction cannot be underestimated.
That's the voice of Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and member of the Korean Peace Network. We're talking to her and Medea Benjamin, anti-war and anti-torture activist and co-founder of Code Pink, about the prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula and Kim Jong-un's visit to China. Medea, I was in Singapore covering the summit, and it was really pretty awful to hear Western media and also the American politicians yelling, taunting Trump about Why didn't he talk more about the human rights situation in North Korea? And I kept thinking to myself, well, when you deprive a people of food or medicine, when you do that as a conscious act, why is that not an abuse of their human rights? I mean, why isn't that just obvious?
Well, yes, but you also can say, how do you give people a chance to have more rights? And that is, you stop isolating them. We've seen this policy for 70 years, and it hasn't opened up the government. So a policy that the U.S. has been pursuing of restricting even the visits of U.S. people to Korea, North Korea, and North Koreans to the U.S., or of the total squeezing of their economy so that they're absolutely dependent on the government for their basic needs, that is not a way to help people obtain a more open society. I think what the South Koreans are proposing now of not only the family reunifications, but the ongoing cultural and diplomatic and people-to-people kind of ties that will be happening very soon, those are going to be remarkably positive in terms of giving the people of North Korea more opportunities to hopefully have a more open society.
Medea, you spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill. What are you hearing in the halls up there about Congress maybe lifting some of these sanctions?
Oh, I don't hear anything.
And so, and Simone has been there. Simone, you're getting just negative feedback from Congress, more or less, right?
Yes, true. The my group met only Democratic senators, and although they were all interested in, you know, the general peace process, they were still very adamant and about the you know, not lifting sanctions and until the North Korea makes you know, progress toward complete denuclearization, so, which was very depressing. And but although that we also tried still, you know, it was actually, I don't want it to be too critical, but because we have to work with we have to learn to work with the senators and the Congress people, and they said that. But some of the advisors who work for the set, the Democratic senators, were actually, I realized that they were truly interested in addressing humanitarian concerns of special children, pregnant women, elderly in North Korea. And a couple of advisors actually really, you know, so that, you know, they also said that we should help, we should work with together so that we can make some progress. So I'm not saying that Democratic senators, U.S. Congress totally oppose it, but I think that I definitely think that there are room. So that means that we have a lot of work to do. And one of our Korean Peace Network advocacy members were doctors who recently returned from North Korea. And he just told us this is horrible, horrible. He visited several major, really major hospitals in North Korea. They, you know, these aren't like small, you know, in country, you know, clinics. He said that they're literally basic things like clean water, basic penicillin, basic medical supplies are just aren't there. So, you know, and so he really gave us very dire, very difficult situation. And so when we provided such testimony, and I got the impression that, you know, really the advisors to Democratic senators were really listening, and I felt that there is a hope. And they said that one more thing I want to mention is that on their part, you know, as you know, that Obama didn't get any Republican support. So they thought that Trump really has not reached out to those Democratic senators and members of Congress. So their position was that, well, you know what, we wanted to work with the administration, but we're not getting any cooperation from Trump administration. So I think here, I think we probably, our activists have a great role to play. We should keep, you know, raising our voice.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That was Simone Chun. Simone is a professor. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute, a member of the Korean Peace Network. And we've also been joined in Washington, D.C. by Medea Benjamin. Medea is an anti-war and anti-torture activist, journalist, author. She's also the co-founder of Code Pink. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco once again by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you never know 2 days before this segment what the lead story will be. But we knew by this morning, Daniel, that the lead segment would have to be what appears to be an advancing trade war between the United States and the People's Republic of China and perhaps many other countries. But we want to focus a little bit on the Trump administration's new announcements for even more tariffs on perhaps as much as $200 billion of Chinese goods. Anyway, it's having an impact as we speak on stock markets and financial markets around the world. Go ahead.
Yeah, yesterday we saw a little bit of a dip on account of the tariffs going into place on the 6th. And then now we're seeing a much more significant one due to the current administration's threats to retaliate against China's retaliation, which was for the initial round of tariffs. China, in response, imposed tariffs on a variety of different American imports that it would bring in. And so now we're seeing the markets react to this, which is to say react badly. So we are seeing an escalation. We're seeing another step in that direction. I think of particular interest is that the Trump administration used the sanctions on ZTE, which is a major Chinese corporation, one of their largest and most wealthy, as a bargaining chip to say to China, hey, we'll remove the sanctions if you give us something. And the Senate actually blocked that and prevented him from removing those sanctions. So there are powerful individuals within the Senate who want to see an escalation of this conflict and want to see an escalating trade war and conflict with China, which is interesting because previously it was sort of the current administration kind of on its own going rogue, doing this tariff thing. And now it seems like there are others within those kind of heights of White House power.
That would include the Democratic Party. Interestingly, when it comes to beating up other countries like DPRK, North Korea, or in this case, China, suddenly Donald Trump is too soft.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it kind of shows the sort of devoid of content aspect of liberalism, where they get angry when you threaten nuclear war with the DPRK and they get angry when you make peace with the DPRK. Either way, they seem completely dissatisfied, even though they're two totally opposite things. And now you see them, jumping on the China's our enemy bandwagon. This is a dangerous development. There are very powerful people within Washington who do want to see an escalating conflict with China, who believe it's inevitable, who believe that China is the real threat, not the Middle East. You notice that the mainstream media isn't talking much about Syria or the significant conflict over there. They've never really talked much about Yemen, but of course there's silence there. But all the conversation, our new big enemy, is the DPRK and China as well as Asia, really. And so this is a troubling escalation in that direction. China has significant power economically. This is a real major power. This isn't these smaller nations that we can kind of kick around. They can move our economy significantly. I mean, just a simple example is the amount of money they put into our treasuries, the amount of money they essentially use to buy U.S. dollars to invest in the U.S. government. There's been a slowdown in their investments, and they can start pulling investments out of it as well. And if we're going to really hurt their economy, they absolutely will do this. And this will devalue the dollar and have a big rippling effect throughout the U.S. economy.
Daniel, I wonder what the end game is here. We can't just keep piling on tariffs back and forth forever. Is this just a negotiating tactic by one or both sides? Are these tariffs going to go away soon, or are we going to have to learn to live with them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it's not totally clear what the end game is. There are also people in power that absolutely don't want to see an escalating trade war. There are powerful elements within kind of corporate society in the United States that are very upset with it. Tariffs and very unhappy. The tech industry is one of them. They really benefit from the free-flowing ability to move capital around and also to purchase technology from anywhere, wherever it's most suitable for their goals. So there are very powerful interests that do not want to see this happening. They are going to fight back as well. And so that's why we're seeing all these contradictions and this flip-flopping and Trump going from sanctioning ZTE to removing the sanctions to having Senate replace them to these continuing threats. I think what the United States wants to see is to, choke China economically, to reduce its power and its influence, to put it in more of its sort of subservient vassal state, where really it was just a place for cheap labor for us to export our capital and get, rock bottom prices and then bring all that money home. That was the goal back in the 70s when we started engaging with them. And it worked, but a lot of money got left behind and the country developed significantly. The Chinese Communist Party retained a great deal of control. You know, the population was not in a state of chaos or unrest, and a strong middle class grew. And now what we're seeing is a China that's really standing up and able to significantly exert influence in the world and is willing to start creating its own global markets, its own global economy, with Chinese interests at the center of that economy. This is something the United States finds unacceptable. Tariffs are these kind of desperate response to that, hoping that they can somehow intimidate it, browbeat it, choke it into some sort of submission.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. You can also subscribe to this show at iTunes or at iHeartRadio. You can hear us every day at SputnikNews.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at LoudClearRadio. Daniel Sankey talks with us every Tuesday about big financial issues. Right now, in the first segment, we're going to continue to talk about the real impact or the possible impact of a growing, escalating trade war between the United States and many countries. But in particular, right now, we're talking about the People's Republic of China. Daniel, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. I'm going to read a couple sentences, and then we'll talk about it. President Trump escalated a trade conflict with China Monday, asking his administration to identify a new list of $200 billion in Chinese goods that would be penalized with new tariffs. The move followed tariffs applied last week on $50 billion in Chinese imports to the United States, designed to punish China for unfair trade practices. Beijing immediately threatened to retaliate with its own equivalent tariffs on U.S. goods. In a statement late Monday, Trump said he now wants U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer to identify the second tranche of goods imported from China for tariffs of at least 10%. That's on these $200 billion of tariffs. Now, for American consumers, that means they will pay more for these goods. Or for American importers, if they're industrial goods, they will pay more. And it also means American manufacturers, relieved from lower prices from overseas competition, will raise prices. The impact on Americans will be generally inflationary. That's correct, right?
Yes, that's right. So what we're going to see is an increase in prices across the board as now these companies have to pay more due to the tariffs. But also because they now are relieved of competition with these foreign sources, they can actually raise the prices on theirs quite a bit, just below the tariff line, right? So they can bump those up with these artificially inflated against the Chinese goods, which are artificially inflated in price, and actually profit more than before the tariffs because of that lack of competition. I think another really important thing to discuss, though, is that because there's going to be these increase in prices and therefore a decrease in profitability because the money is really just going to go to tariffs, what we're going to see is more layoffs, especially in the sectors that Trump supposedly, you know, cares deeply about and really campaigned on, the industrial kind of rust belt that's really been hollowed out ever since the 70s. We're going to see more layoffs in that area because all these inputs that come from China that are used to build cars, to build, you know, air conditioning units, refrigerators, washing machines. I mean, all these goods that almost everyone uses, the increase in prices is going to cause manufacturing here to lay off more people as they try to recoup profits that are lost through it. So this is not a win for working people. They're going to have to pay more at the cash register, and then they're going to have to pay more in terms of a loss of jobs and a loss in income.
I want to ask you about that. The Chinese have imposed sanctions or tariffs on things like pork and blueberries and a wide variety of things, blue jeans. So are we talking about workers in even those industries, those farm production industries taking a hit?
Yeah, the agricultural sector is concerned. this increase in tariffs will mean that people in China will turn towards domestic producers of those particular products first, because they'll be significantly cheaper. So, you know, even Trump has acknowledged that this is a unfair attack on the, you know, agriculture industry, our farmers, which are, you know, our backbone. And so they're concerned as well. And that's going to hurt their bottom line. That's going to hurt their ability to employ people. We do a lot in this country to kind of prop up the agricultural industry. There's huge subsidies we provide to kind of keep them afloat and allow them to compete with foreign entities. But this will hurt their bottom line as well. I mean, really, it's kind of a lose-lose across the board. Consumers are going to be hurt one way or another. And really what this is this kind of ideological drive that China is now our enemy and we have to try to strangle it economically, even though it hurts our own citizens, even though it's not really in their own interests or to their own benefits, because you know, this phantom menace of China somehow taking over everything, which is really ridiculous. The United States remains an immense global power, far outranking China in wealth, in military, in almost kind of every category you can imagine. And this idea that the Chinese are somehow abusing us or taking advantage of us is crazy. They simply lack the power to do that in any significant way. And this escalation, though, will test that. And so it's really a lose-lose all around.
That's Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. He joins Loud and Clear every Tuesday to talk about big economic issues of the day and of the week. This segment, we're talking about China. Again, I don't know, John, I'm just hooked on the Wall Street Journal today. I want to look at, you know.
Just stay away from the editorial page and you're okay.
Okay, yeah, I think you're right there. Tariffs start to ripple their way through the U.S. economy. This is exactly what we're talking about. Effects are like a tax increase, very small at this point, but reducing gross domestic product and eroding real wages. And here's the article. It starts, in recent weeks, several major rounds of tariffs have moved from proposals to realities, and major new tariffs have been threatened, shifting the stakes for President Trump's trade actions. And then it goes over about how it's already starting to function as a tax increase on some goods. And thus, as prices go up, that means we can buy less with our wages.
That's right.
So it's like a wage cut. So you can say, yes, we're protecting the steel industry or the aluminum industry, or we're helping, as Trump is trying to leverage American state power to insist that Chinese companies not have the benefit of technology transfer, which was the quid pro quo for China. China said to American and Western corporations, yeah, you can come here. You can come to China. You can set up shop. You can employ labor at lower wages, much lower than in your own country. And you get to sell to this market that has $1.3 billion. But in exchange for that opportunity, we, the Chinese, are going to insist that some of the technology, which in the past was the monopoly of the advanced capitalists, mm-hmm. that is colonial powers, that some of that transfer to a Chinese companies, so they could develop their own indigenous economy rather than look like neocolonial slaves. No American corporation was put in jail and had a gun put to their head. That was the deal. You want the market, you want lower wage workers, here's the deal. You have to transfer technology. Donald Trump is saying, as a consequence of trying to help those American capitalists retain full monopoly on those technologies, that average people are going to pay higher prices. I mean, you know, this American nationalism, America First stuff actually confuses the picture, because what's not explained is that what's good for American capitalists in China may not be good for American working people, say, in Wisconsin or in Western Pennsylvania. We're not one nation united. We may have different economic interests. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, we certainly do. And I think it's really important to show that the reason why China was able to kind of demand those technology transfers and sort of say, hey, if you're going to benefit from us, we want to benefit from you, is because they had a strong and united government. They weren't this kind of weak neo-colonial sort of fragmented society. They had a common identity as Chinese people. They saw the Chinese Communist Party as a point of unity amongst them. And it really created tremendous political force and power that made them say, look, you know, you want to take advantage of cheap labor here, fine, but we want something back. You can't just come here and take everything. Well, that's unacceptable to the Washington consensus. That's unacceptable to kind of neoliberal capitalists here in the United States. What they need is a pliant state that does what it's required, that does what it's asked to, that can be taken advantage of, that can have its resources and its capital funneled out by powerful U.S. corporations. Now, in many ways, we did take advantage of China like that. But the balance of power never shifted so completely just in our favor. And now it is shifting back the other way. I think one of the most important things is that workers start to understand that it's not China versus the United States, that as far as workers are concerned, workers in China and workers here in the U.S. are both exploited people struggling to make a living, struggling to pay their rents, feed their kids, and have some kind of future for each other. And both of them are taken advantage of by very wealthy, very powerful forces. Now, those forces tell them, hey, those workers over there in China, they're your enemies. You vote for us and we'll take care of them. We'll deal with them for you. The truth is, though, that both of those groups are exploited, and that when we allow these powerful ruling class, powerful capitalist forces to direct us, we ultimately are simply benefiting them rather than each other. So it's really important, I think, for our listeners to understand that as working people, that their enemies are not Chinese workers who, just like them, are struggling to make it. Their enemies are the very wealthy, very powerful over them, both here in the United States and abroad.
Daniel, I'd like to ask you about the politics of this, too. And the reason I'm even bringing it up is because I think that so many Americans have underestimated Donald Trump politically. He doesn't do things on the spur of the moment, even though they may appear to have been done on the spur of the moment. I think he really puts a lot of political thought into many of these actions. The unions in the Rust Belt have to be loving this. He's got to be winning support among auto workers and steel workers and aluminum workers and coal miners. But then at the same time, he's hurting those very farmers in the Midwest who supported him in the 2016 election. So help us work our way through the politics of this.
Yeah, I mean, really, these sectors, these working groups have really been largely forgotten by, you know, our society. These workers have largely been ignored, and their industries have been allowed to kind of get hollowed out and rust and collapse as capital moves abroad to countries like China and many others. And so for the first time to have a politician of significant rank and power is Donald Trump actually fighting for them and saying, it's unfair what's happened to you. You deserve better than your circumstances. And he's absolutely right. They certainly do. It's extremely empowering. The problem is, though, it's also extremely dishonest. You know, okay, so you're protecting the steel industry so they don't have to compete with Chinese imports. But then all those other industries that depend on steel, of which there are many, end up being hurt by an increase in prices because our steel capacity isn't sufficient to meet that demand. So they have to pay higher prices or seek it elsewhere or purchase things of lower quality for higher prices. Well, in turn, then their workers are hurt. So, you know, maybe the steel unions are excited about it, but the problem is other workers elsewhere are hurt by it. And this is really kind of goes back to what I was saying before, that other workers and other industries are not your enemy. There is a need to have real solidarity with them and to understand that regardless of whether they're working in the steel industry like you and are part of your union or in another industry and part of a different union or not part of a union at all, that their needs are a vital concern. And that when you tie your horse to Donald Trump, what you get is a little bit of benefit at a whole lot of cost and a whole lot of weakening. And that's what we're seeing here. So, you know, I'm not angry at these steel workers. I understand that for the first time they're hearing rhetoric in Washington that actually speaks to their needs for the first time in a long time. So you can hardly blame them for listening to that. But they need to also be smart enough to understand why they're saying it. They're not, these billionaires are not concerned with steel workers. These billionaires are not concerned with working people. They're concerned with their own political agenda, which is what we're seeing here.
And the other part of the fallacy of this approach is that the steel companies, you know, let's say U.S. Steel, for instance, let's just take one steel company, but it could be any steel company. They're competing in terms of the home market, the domestic market, and they're also competing internationally. So they can't arbitrarily set the price of steel. if the price of steel is arbitrarily set too high or higher than their competitors will get the market, right? I mean, that's the way things work in a competitive market. Now, what is the feature that lowers the price of a particular commodity? In this case, let's talk about steel, but it could be true for any commodity. What would reduce the price would be lowering the cost of production. And lowering the cost of production means introducing new technologies that take the place of living labor. In other words, the tendency towards machinery, towards automation, towards robotics, it becomes uniform. It's across the board. Because otherwise, whatever company, whatever enterprise does not introduce the new technology, it won't be as competitive. It won't be able to sell its products in the global market. So if U.S. steel gets stronger, what it will do with the money is not hire a whole bunch of living human beings to be steel workers. It's going to invest in additional automation and robotics. I mean, the problem is not, this is a Band-Aid approach. It's not even a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid that will immediately fall off.
Exactly. And compound that with the fact that these companies have gotten a huge giveaway from the GOP tax plan. So already their revenues are spiking because of their reducing taxes. Then combine it with the tariffs, which are also going to artificially inflate their prices. And that's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to use that money to automate things still further. You know, companies are going to do things cheaper. Any way they can. And that might mean exploiting workers, busting unions, lowering their wages, taking away benefits. So now you work for cheaper, or it's automation so that you just need less of those workers that you have to pay for. You know, so they're going to go after either tactic, right? But right now, what it looks like is that regardless of what other tactic they take, the workers are the ones that lose. They either get laid off because a robot took their job, or they're forced to accept lower wages and less benefits. But in both situations, they lose. And that's a really important thing to understand, that these profits that they're going to reap are not going to be passed on to workers. There's no reason for them to benefit them in that way if they can simply replace them.
Daniel, I want to ask you about another piece that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, which seems to be our favorite newspaper this week.
Just today.
I went to Europe a couple of months ago, and I was surprised at how weak the dollar was. It was very expensive when I was there. Well, just in the last 2 months, the dollar has risen more than 15%, coupled with a pretty strong increase in the price of oil. It's making things now in Europe very, very expensive. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important for us to understand that the dollar is really the global currency. So almost all commodities, and that includes oil, are purchased in dollars. So what that means is all these countries, if they want to gain access to the commodities they need to function, they have to buy it in dollars. So they have to buy dollars from us. They have to take their currency, their wealth, and put it into the United States in exchange for dollars. This causes the dollar to have this hugely inflated price, and it causes that to increase tremendously. So in the United States, a stronger dollar might mean, oh, I can buy more with less dollars, which is great. Abroad, it really hurts these global economies and causes them to struggle tremendously. Same thing with the price of oil increasing, because it's a double whammy. The oil price goes up and the dollar price goes up. So now you have two factors that are contributing to this huge inflation. And that's really wreaking havoc in Europe and many other places as well, especially now in the context of us entering into some kind of, I don't know, trade war might be too strong, but we're levying tariffs against, you know, European allies and threatening them in these ways. Additionally, we're having a stronger dollar, and it's really playing havoc in Europe and really, frankly, fraying and weakening the U.S. relationships with these countries. I think this is one way the U.S. Kind of has economic dominance over the world, is by forcing the world to use its dollars rather than their own currencies.
I want to talk also about, we talked about the domestic politics of the trade war with China, or the trade war with China and other countries. Let's talk about the geostrategic, that is, world politics. Again, guess what I'm looking at, John?
Yeah, it's got to be the Wall Street Journal.
It is the Wall Street Journal. The title is Strange Bedfellows, Trump's Trade Fight Brings Japan and China Together. Prime Minister Abe, that's Japan, is promoting a rapprochement with Beijing that reflects Tokyo's needs for allies in upholding the post-war free trading system. And sure enough, you have the Chinese leadership now visiting Japan. And historically, of course, because of Japan's terrible history of colonialization and militarism and intervention and occupation of China, the idea that China and Japan could become friends, that's quite something, really something if you know the political dynamics and the historical dynamics. But here you have Donald Trump putting steep tariffs also on Japan, and Japan expected to have waivers so that Japan, because it's an allied country, 50,000 American troops occupy Japan. There's 11 military bases, U.S. bases in Japan. Japan expected to be treated a little bit differently than America's adversaries, but not with Donald Trump. So now you have Abe in Japan, right-wing nationalist, who's been fighting China over all these disputed territories, these islands in the South China Sea, now getting closer to China as a consequence. They both have a common foe suddenly, and that is the government in Washington.
Exactly. I mean, the way that Trump is imposing all these tariffs is extremely ignorant and non-strategic. I mean, it's forcing Europe to look east towards Russia, where there's the opportunity to build various trade relationships with them, with a country that is very eager to give them very favorable trade terms. And now China and Japan, you know, two countries that are supposedly mortal enemies, that, you know, their rivalry goes way back. You know, Japan imports a tremendous amount of its goods. It doesn't have a huge domestic market for a lot of its commodities. And so it's very dependent, especially on energy, oil imports. It doesn't have, you know, oil facilities there. And now it's looking towards these other countries to build some kind of block, because what they're seeing in the United States is that, you know, we're not trustworthy. We'll flip-flop, we'll change, we'll put tariffs on allies that have spent decades building relationships with us. And really, the Trump effect shows that there's this fragility to the U.S. empire, that if someone like Trump can take office now, even if he doesn't win a second term, someone like Trump could take office again. And now these other countries are starting to look to make deals with one another to protect themselves from a United States that largely seems more and more erratic and untrustworthy.
And even though Trump seems like a maverick, the fact that that the U.S. Senate actually has overturned or is moving to overturn Donald Trump's relief to the Chinese technology company, ZTE, which will shut down because it's dependent on American suppliers. And 80,000 workers in China will lose their jobs as a consequence. So now we have the Democrats and Republicans demanding that Trump be tougher still on China. So it's not, well, it is Trump. It shows he's moved the ball, the point, the locus of the debate, and it's moving further and further to the right. We have about 30 seconds, John.
It also shows the corruption of the duopoly that we have running this country, where both parties are perfectly happy to switch sides depending on who's in the White House. A couple of years ago, the Republicans were criticizing Barack Obama for negotiating with the Iranians and the Cubans. Now they're now the Democrats are criticizing Donald Trump for negotiating with the North Koreans. They don't care about what's best for the country. They care about what's best for their party. And it's the same thing economically. That's why we're seeing these tariffs and the reaction then to these tariffs.
They agree on one thing, and that is giving the Pentagon ever more money, our money, every year. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined by Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst. Every Tuesday here on Loud and Clear, you can hear Daniel Sankey, his analysis, his assessment on a segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.